Amy Hall. I'm here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to the Hashtag STR Ask podcast from Stand to Reason. And now I have a question for Greg. This first question comes from Emma. Many people point out that God used imperfect people throughout the Bible, and this is good news for us. While I agree, why did he seem to forgive and use people like David or Jacob, but send his wrath down on others like the man gathering wood on the Sabbath?
Well, I'm trying to imagine the mind of God on this, and this is one of those questions, why did God and why didn't God? And the liability of those questions is we have to think about what it is that God had in mind when he did or didn't do these things. The answers to these questions are related to larger issues. Issues that are outside of our purview, which is the liability of these kinds of questions. But let's just take David, for example. David was a king. He occupied a very, very significant place in the country and in God's redemptive history. Also, this sin was not characteristic of his life. He was actually a man after God's own heart. And he had this serious failing, not just adultery, but murder as well. And consequently, this was a huge mark in David's life. But God had purposes beyond this. Did David get disciplined? Yes, David got disciplined. Badly. Harshly, I should say, not badly. Harshly. His house was divided from that point. And soon later, his own son, Absalom, rebelled against him, and he had to flee for his own life. And his whole life was kind of topsy turvy ever since that time of glory when he was doing well and then fell with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite, her husband, who he had essentially executed, put him at the front line of the battle till he died. And so, it isn't like God just dealt lightly and kind of looked askance at those little peccadilloes kind of thing. No, he didn't destroy David. He could have, but he didn't. Why didn't he? Well, he had his own reasons why he didn't destroy David, but he did destroy others in an act of judgment. Achan is another example of destruction that God brought as a result in the book of Joshua as a result of disobedience that brought a lot of harm onto the nation. So why didn't God do the same? You know, that's up to him. I can't tell you what was in his mind, but David was a singular individual. And we don't know, by the way, how many times God showed mercy to other less famous people. It's not recorded. What's recorded are the things that are necessary for us to understand for the unraveling of salvation history, you know, going from the problem to the ultimate solution.
Yeah, I think the answer could just be as simple as the fact that it's God's choice whether he shows grace or he shows judgment, because they both deserve judgment. So the question is not why were the other people judged, but why did God show grace?
Mm, that's good, Amy. That's better than mine.
So
why don't we start with you? Then I can just say, I agree. Let's move on to the next question.
So when God chose David, so obviously David was also repentant, but I think that's a reflection of God's grace. The man gathering the sticks, there's no indication that he was repentant. He was deliberately disobeying God for whatever reason and kind of thumbing his nose at the covenant that they had just made with God.
And it was a recent covenant. It was just made. It was
right.
Laid down, and God's showing, wow, he's serious about this stuff.
Right.
So, but it's curious. That was just one day with the Sabbath. There was also a Sabbath rest meant for the land, which went for 490 years without being observed. And that's why for 70 years there was a Babylonian captivity to give the land the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So the boom ultimately fell on Israel, but almost a half a millennium later, you know, at the end of all of this, and then God had his justice with the nation.
And I think it's I think it's hard for us to grasp the idea that God chooses to show grace to some and not to others. And this isn't to say that God would turn away someone who's repentant. It's just what I'm saying is that people are repentant because of God's grace to begin with.
Curiously, though, even in David's repentance, there were still consequences.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I mean, he was tricked into seeing his guilt, although he probably was aware of it before that. The Psalms show that he labored regarding that stuff. But Nathan the prophet nailed him. You are the man. And whoa, that was it. That's when David publicly repented and relented of his attitude of sin there and confessed, etc. But still, there were serious consequences for his behavior.
And I think that the Bible makes a distinction between God's discipline, which I think that was, versus his judgment, which is, I guess,
the judgment in that case was death. Both were capital crimes. Adultery and murder were capital crimes under the law.
So I just wanted to read a quick passage talking about God choosing grace or judgment in Romans 9, because in Romans 9, Paul's asking about, you know, why did God choose Jacob and not Esau? Because they were both in the line of Abraham, but God chose Jacob. And it says, there was Rebekah also, when she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac. For though the twins were not yet born and had not done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. So it was just merely a matter of God's grace. He wanted to use Jacob for his plan, and he chose to show him grace that he didn't deserve.
Plus, there was that custom of, primogeniture, the idea that the firstborn gets the glory, you know, gets the stuff, gets the blessing, et cetera, et cetera. And God just bypassed that in each of those cases.
Okay, let's go on to another question. This one comes from Alex Smith. I am realizing that I have an overly critical spirit. What advice can you offer to those of us struggling with this?
Well, oh my boy. I'm the right person to ask because I have the same liability. Now, fortunately, I found a way to make a living at it. But most people aren't that they're lucky in that sense. And also, it does have personal liabilities, okay? So I have a verse that I read a couple times a week, and it comes up on my task thing, and it's in Colossians somewhere. It says, do all things without grumbling or disputing, okay? So a critical spirit is somebody, especially if you're talking about it, you're grumbling about it. You're finding things wrong. And the instruction is, stop doing that. Now, the implication is that it's within our power to stop doing that, even though the impulse is strong to do it. So what I have had to do is work at not expressing my discontent or complaining or broadcasting the shortcomings of people or circumstances around me. By the way, this is very hard to do. It's hard to stop. And my father was very critical, and I think I picked up the habit from my father. So he was much more critical than I am, but I still, my impulse is to be critical of people. And when the impulse expresses itself in my mind, I'm aware of that. I'm looking at a circumstance. I'm saying, I have critical thoughts. I just have to confess it and then try to move on, try to stop and move on. But this is like a lot of character vices, these are things that don't just disappear when you become a Christian. We learn whatever the vice happens to be. Oftentimes, we learn how to defeat it day by day. It doesn't just go away. There are exceptions to that. There are certain things that people have as vices in their lives, and when they become Christians, the way the Holy Spirit is working in them is to have an immediate transformation in certain areas. Doesn't mean all areas are all areas of habits are transformed. We're new creatures, but sometimes that means a habit that we had, a vice, disappears, and it also means that other vices that we have get worked on over time. And in my case, this is one of those things that just gets worked on over time. I've been a Christian 45 years, and I still really have to struggle with this. The biggest problem with this vice is when it manifests itself in a family environment. And this is where we have to be especially vigilant. If we're fault finders in general, we annoy a lot of people. But if we are fault finders in our home, we destroy relationships, or at least seriously harm them. And that's where we have to be most vigilant. So I've actually written a couple of mentoring letters regarding this. I can just tell you what they were about. One of them is when I talk about giving them heaven, give them heaven, right? And I talk about that. I end every show with that line. But then I started thinking, will people say, those who encounter me, not necessarily in a professional environment because I'm on my best behavior then, but in general other environments or in my home, would they say that here's a guy who gives them heaven? When I asked that question, I didn't like the answer that I came up with. So I wrote a little bit about that, and I talked about how I am trying to deal with that in three different types of environments, and one was in my home. I don't know offhand, maybe you can post this, Amy, what which mentoring letter that was. But a recent one, though, I did on three ways to improve your marriage and all your relationships. I think this was
February.
I talked also about not finding fault, not picking at little things, correcting people on inconsequentials. Critical people do that, and this is not kind to them. And so I was talking about how kindness is a powerful tactic, and it's also good manners, and it's virtuous. So there are some places where I talk about how I'm working in my own life to manage that same difficulty.
I think this is a common problem among people who are interested in apologetics. It's like you said, you're making your living looking at things and examining them and finding where they go wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think every gift that we have has a downside if it's used in the wrong way. And so a lot of times people who are interested in apologetics will have this particular downfall mm-hmm. in their lives that they have to fight.
Yeah, I don't think apologetics causes that. I think people who have that get interested in apologetics. The tail's wagging the dog.
Right. There. And I think obviously praying about this is a huge deal, but just be prepared for God to humble you, because I think that's a huge way that he addresses this in people's hearts and in my own too.
Be especially vigilant, though, if you have a critical spirit regarding the relationships that are closest to you, your children and your spouse. Those are the most critical relationships that are vulnerable to somebody who's critical.
I would say probably also church relationships, relationships with the pastor, all these things I think are dangerous. Okay, let's take a question from Susan. How can we fight against the apathy that is so prevalent around us in church, school, everywhere?
Well, this is a very common question I get, and I'm always at somewhat of a loss to answer it, okay? People are apathetic about things they don't care about. That's the nature of apathy. They're not apathetic about things they care about. So I guess I've been saying more recently, one way to deal with apathy in non-Christians is to ask them questions about things. And which is a standard tactical approach, but by asking them questions, if they're willing to answer them, we may be able to use questions that can get them thinking about spiritual things. One question that I got from J. Warner Wallace, but he got it from somebody else, a great little question is, what do you think happens when you die? It's a great question. you could lead up to it, you know. You don't just spring it on somebody. You say, you know, I want to ask you a question, if it's all right. Maybe a little personal or not, but it's something I've been thinking about. And if you don't want to answer, that's fine with me too, but I was just curious. Do you mind if I ask? Well, if you place it that way, people are always going to be curious enough to find out what the question is. What do you think happens when you die? Then let them answer. Who knows what they're going to say? But now you're getting them to be actively thinking about spiritual things. But they might say, well, I don't know and I don't care. Then I would say, why wouldn't you care? If you don't know, then there's a number of possibilities, which would be hell. Certainly a possibility. Well, I don't believe in hell. No, okay, fine. But is it possible? If it's possible, then why don't you believe in hell anyway? I'm just curious. So in other words, if the environment is such that you can continue to pursue more questions, virtually anything the person responds with will invite more probing questions for your understanding of them, or maybe the reasons why they think they believe what they do. So there's a way of kind of sparking some interest, probing questions. I think to get Christians more less apathetic, it a lot depends on what they're apathetic about. If they're apathetic about their relationship with God, I'm not sure, you know, well, that's different. If they don't, they're apathetic about Christianity, though they call themselves Christians, why are they wasting their time? Christianity is not fun. It's inconvenient. So if you don't care about it, why do the inconvenient stuff that's associated with Christianity? I don't know. That's another issue. But sometimes people are apathetic about they are genuine Christians, it seems, but they're apathetic about engaging other people or apathetic about apologetics. And this is where we think of something like atheist role play is really good. Yeah, our whole church is really apathetic. Oh, good. Invite an atheist to speak on Sunday morning. Have them come in and give us talk. We can't do that. Why not? That'll really get people stirred up. That's the point. So people who are confronted with the challenges, now that changes things a bit. So there's another idea.
Yeah, I think especially when you're talking in terms of non-Christians, there probably is no really good short-term. Like if you just have a few minutes with someone, it's hard to imagine getting someone who's apathetic, really excited about anything. But I think you have more of a chance with somebody you know, because the Christian worldview encompasses everything. It touches on everything. So they must care about something. There must be something they care about. And if you know them well enough to know what they care about, how does the Christian worldview affect that thing? How does it interact with that thing? That could be a way to get started because it's something they already care about. And if it's something worth caring about, then it's connected to Christianity because all good things come from God. And so you can show them how that works and how if God doesn't exist, how that thing that they love won't be there.
But let me just close with this thought. There's no silver bullet on this. Some people just don't care. And it's going to take an act of God to get them to care. And generally, that act of God means certain things happen in their life that shock them out of their complacency. And that's the way a lot of people get straightened out. They get racked out of their complacency, and they realize the world's a lot more dangerous place than they thought. And there are more important things to think about than their own personal satisfaction in the morning, in the moment, rather.
So don't be surprised if you're praying for someone and their life falls apart. It's your fault for praying.
But it's a good thing, oftentimes.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone, for sending us your questions on Twitter. We look forward to hearing from you because we cannot do this show without your questions. So please keep sending those in. We'll accept those through Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk, or you can go through our website, use the contact form, or go to our broadcast page and send us a question. Just make sure it's short, like a tweet, which is only 280 characters. So we will consider questions from either of those places, and we look forward to hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.